Oh, that's right. We're right here this afternoon. How you doing? I'm Ann Eller, and today it is my very great honor to talk with retired U.S. Army Colonel Denny Burroughs Jr. Actually, I guess your first name is Willis. I understand why you go by Denny, right?
Oh, that's right. Yes.
And
My grandmother did that to me.
your grandmother did that to you. And you have written a book, Birds on the Wire and Flares on the Perimeter. This is back from the Vietnam War era, and it is my very great, great honor to have you on the show today. And first off, I want to thank you for your service, for all the things you've done for our country and a whole lot of young people as being a superintendent and biology teacher and all those good things, Denny.
Okay, well, thank you, Ann. I appreciate it, and I'm happy to be here today, so I appreciate you having me.
Absolutely. Well, I guess we should start out with what prompted you to write this book, Birds on the Wire and Flares on the Perimeter? And we need to tell everybody before we get started, you're going to be at McCaslin's Bookstore this Saturday from, what is it, 11?
Yeah, 11 to 1. Yes.
11 to
Uh-huh.
1. And he'll be there signing books and talking about his book. And so I thought, what better time to help give it even a little more push? I know it's going to be a success on Saturday, but we are so excited that you are here today. So, why did you write this book?
Well, actually, way back a number of years ago, I felt like, my grandkids needed to know what their papa went through during the war. Not that I did anything that spectacular, but just the experience of what I went through. And they don't know anything about it. They're at this age, when they're young, they're not really that interested in what I did unless I was shooting at people and killing bad guys and stuff like this, which I didn't do. But I wanted them to know down the road what their papa did. So I started putting it on paper, and my intent was just to write it down and hand them a packet full of papers that I ran off on my printer at home and give it to them for Christmas one year or something. But my wife, Joanne, continued to encourage me, and she finally convinced me to have it published. So here I am. I've got the book published, and my grandkids have it in their hands. They got it just after Christmas. Didn't quite make it by Christmas this year, but got it as a late Christmas present. So they now know what their papa did.
That's right. And the title, Birds on the Wire and Flares on the Perimeter. What does that mean?
Well, there's not much to the story, really, when you think about it, but it just kind of stuck. But I was just like everybody else over there. I had a camera in my hand a good bit of the time, and I love to take pictures with my camera, obviously. But I had gotten a zoom lens to go with a telephoto lens, and I was experimenting one day, well, a number of days, and I saw some birds sitting on a wire on a power line at my base camp. So I just started taking them, took a regular picture of the birds, and then I would take a picture with the telephoto lens and so on to see what the differences were. And I wound up taking, I probably sent 10, 15 slides home to my parents of birds on the wire. I wasn't married at that time, so I mailed most of that stuff to my parents. And the same thing, I'd go out at night when the flares were being used on the perimeter of the base camp, and I'd take pictures of those, and sometimes I'd leave the shutter open and wiggle it a little bit and make designs and this kind of stuff, and I'd sent those home. Well, later on, when I got back home, they said, "Why did you send us so many pictures of birds on the wire and flares on the perimeter?" And it just stuck. I said, "Hey, that's a title for my book now." So that's how it came to be. Really, it
Wow.
was because I was taking pictures with my new camera at the time.
Now, where were you located in Vietnam?
Okay, I was at a base camp. It was a base camp of the 25th Infantry Division, about 30 miles northwest of Saigon. And I was stationed with the 12th Evacuation Hospital, which was a large, it was 400-bed hospital,
Wow.
Capable of all kinds of surgery and this type of stuff. So
I didn't know you
and
were a doctor.
No, I'm not a doctor. I'm a medical administrator. Medical administrator, not a doctor. But on my ID card, I did have the Red Cross, just like every medic in Vietnam had. So, but I didn't do much medical stuff. I was more the handling other things. And my job, I was the S1 for the hospital, which is the personnel officer, and I had to handle all the stuff dealing with the hospital personnel as well as the locals that we hired to do the stuff at the hospital, you know, working in the wards or whatever, a lot of different things they did. And I had to hire them, supervise them, fire them if necessary, pay them, this type thing. Wow. As well as keeping up with all the U.S. personnel that were at the hospital. I had to make sure they got promoted, they got their R&Rs and everything else under the sun. So,
now, what years were you actually in Vietnam?
I was there from August 1969 to August 1970.
So
I entered active duty in 68, September of 68. But I spent a year at Fort Hood first, Fort Hood, Texas, and then went to Vietnam from there.
Well, you know, when you look at Fort Hood today and what happened several years ago with the guy that went in there and shot everything up, did that bring back any memories about being at Fort Hood or anything?
Yeah, I mean, that was close to me. I mean, I watched that avidly for however long it went on, several weeks that they were talking about it and everything, and I was very interested in it. But the fort has changed so much. There's a lot of stuff in pictures I didn't recognize or anything, because back when I went, most of the buildings were still old World War II type buildings, the old barracks and things like that. So.
Yeah, we forget, really, that the end of World War II, and then we had the Korean War, and then, of course, Vietnam, those weren't that old at that point.
No, at that time, they were about 25 to 30 years old.
So. Yeah, so.
It wasn't that far long ago, and now it is. But you go down to Fort Jackson now, it's a whole lot different from the way it looked when I first went on active duty.
Yeah. So how did you, so let's take it back to, you are from Greenville. You were here in Greenwood, I understand, for a little bit. Then you moved with your family to Greenville.
That's correct, Yeah, my dad worked for Pet Dairy in Greenville, and he had worked for the packing plant down here in Greenwood, but we only lived here roughly about a year before we went to Greenville. And so I grew up there, was raised there. I was actually born in Virginia, but as of this morning's newspaper, I'm not claiming that
not
too
claiming
much.
Virginia.
No, I'm not too happy with some of those Virginians right now.
Yeah.
So with the abortion issue and everything.
Absolutely. It's just horrifying. Horrifying.
It is horrifying. It's.
I don't know where we're going in this country.
We're getting too socialist for one thing, socialist leanings, and it's reminiscent of the beginnings of the Holocaust or something of that nature. And it scares me. It really does.
Yeah, it does me too. Mm-hmm. But so you grew up in Greenville. You you were in high school. What did you want to do when you were in high school and everything? What were you thinking?
Actually, when I was in high school, junior high and high school, I was active in Boy Scouts. I was avid scouter, really, and loved everything about it, wearing uniforms and camping and you name it, and we did it, so I've just kind of been oriented towards something with uniforms, and the older I got, the more I started thinking about, maybe a military career, and somewhere along the way, I just decided the Army was what I wanted. I finally decided when I got into college, but entered college.
You went to Furman.
I went to Furman, and I was in ROTC at Furman. And the first 2 years of ROTC was required of everybody that went to Furman. You had to take those 2 years. But I loved every second of it.
How were you doing over there now, Denny? We got to talk about this educational level. How were you doing on being able to stay in the ROTC program?
Okay. That's a loaded question.
Loaded.
And
okay.
You know it.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
When I started out at Furman as a freshman, I joined the drill team. I got invited to join the drill team just a few days after I arrived as a freshman. That's the Pershing Rifles drill team. And so I drilled and marched a whole lot. I played a whole lot of bridge and kind of forgot about the books. My first 2 years were pretty close to probably the best word to describe it was be disastrous. The only thing I did was, at that time, I stayed off of academic probation. That's the best thing I can say. And I'm not proud of it.
Right.
But I say it just to say that somewhere along the way, I changed. And part of that change was due to, actually, to the professors in ROTC.
Okay.
Because they had faith in me, and they accepted me into the advanced course.
Well, I know you were really worried about getting into that advanced course, right?
Yes, I was, because my grades, academically speaking, my grades didn't qualify to be accepted into the advanced course. So I went begging a whole lot to my professor, asking him to please put in a good word for me to the commandant to see if he could accept me, conditionally at least.
Right.
And I think it was in July before the school year started in August, I went back to him one final time to just beg and plead with him, and he just held up his hand and said, "You're in."
Now
they
leave
had
me
accepted
alone.
Me. There were several of us. There were a number of us that didn't have the academics that
borderline.
We needed.
We were borderline.
We were borderline.
There
yes, definitely borderline. And they, in good faith, they took a chance on us. And I still remember Captain. It was Captain Jerry Henderson, Jerry Y. Henderson. If he's out there somewhere, I'd love to meet him again and see him, because I thank him for basically saving me. But once I was accepted into advanced ROTC, then that kept me in, gave me a deferment to finish school, and it also gave me the opportunity to get a commission in the Army, which I, at that point, I was wanting badly.
And, now, you couldn't go, though. Your eyesight was an issue as far as being in the...
Yeah. Well, in advanced ROTC, as we progressed through it, we had to... request what branch we wanted to go into. And you know, the way it was set up, everybody had to request three branches, first, second, third choice. One of the branch requests had to be a combat arms branch, such as artillery or infantry or armor, those three. Except in my case, I had, my vision was 2200, which means I couldn't see more than about 3 feet in front
of me. That's a little different than 20/20.
A whole lot of difference there. So I didn't qualify for combat arms as far as the vision goes. So I had to put down three other choices. So I put down medical service, which was my first choice anyway, because that's what I wanted. I put down chemical, and I think I put down MPs, which that was as close to combat as I could get, and so I did put down that as a choice. But my first choice was medical, and as it turns out, I got my first choice. And I was just tickled to death, because we got to wear the caduceus. Even though we would be medical administrators, we wore the medical emblem on the uniform. And ours was cool because it was the only silver one in the bunch. Everybody else's was gold. Ours was silver. So I loved it.
You loved it. Well, that's great. So what happened after you graduated then?
Well, after graduation, because my grade GPA was so tight and everything, and in order to graduate on time, I had to defer my ROTC summer camp until the end, until after I graduated. Normally, you go to summer camp for 6 weeks at Fort Bragg between your junior and senior years. Well, I had to go to school then in order to graduate. So I requested that it be deferred till after my senior year. So it was. And so I went to summer camp, went to Fort Bragg for 6 weeks right after graduation. And that in itself was an experience. When I got there, I found out early on our TAC officer, who was the Army officer in charge of us, he was calling in everybody just to get to know them and find out a little bit about everybody. And when I reported to his office, he had already talked to a number of people. When I reported to his office, he called me in And I reported, you know, Captain, Cadet Burroughs reporting as ordered, sir. And I was real snappy. And from that point on, he proceeded to chew me out for everything I was worth. I mean, he chewed me up one side and down the other for having a rotten attitude, you know, a just-get-by attitude, which, honestly, I had. But I didn't know he knew it. And
your reputation preceded you, is what you're saying.
In about 15 minutes, he convinced me that I was going to be the most gung-ho cadet up there for summer camp, which I tried to be from that point on. But and I do thank him from this day that, for all he did. If you get my book, you can read all about it because it's in the book, too. So,
you know, it is amazing, I think, the influence that people have on us, that particularly at the time, we don't understand why.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Well, that's one of the points I make in the closing of my book, actually, is that all along the way, there have been people who have guided me in the right direction, whether it was God's intention or an angel or whatever it was, mm-hmm. or just circumstance, you know, but there's always been somebody there that kind of moved me in the right direction.
I think Joanne would think that, right?
Yes, and Joanne yeah, Joanne was one of them.
Well, that's, so, you know, I think that's very neat. And after you did that 6 weeks, then did you go into the service?
Yeah, actually, I was commissioned as a second lieutenant at the end of that 6 weeks in the theater up there at Fort Bragg. My best friend, who happened to be a Green Beret at Fort Bragg at the time, I had asked him to pin my bars on me, and he did. And so I went home as a full-fledged second lieutenant.
Now, question. You. Mm-hmm. This was, of course, during the Vietnam War. Did mm-hmm. you have any issues with wearing your uniform? I mean, I know you were proud of your uniform. Mm-hmm. Did you have any issues with people and the disparaging of the uniform, of the fact that you were in the military in that mm-hmm. time?
No. I never experienced anything like that. Even, you know, when I was going over to Vietnam, I wound up, like I was telling you earlier, I wound up in San Francisco International Airport in the morning. My luggage was still in Atlanta, and I had to wait all day long for it to arrive on another flight. And that whole day, I was in uniform, roaming around the airport, and didn't have a bit of problem. Coming back home, when we were out processing, they had told us, you might want to consider the circumstances and not wear your uniform home. And my reaction to that was, you crazy as a loon. You know, I've earned the right to wear this uniform, and I'm going to wear it. But even then, I had no problems. So other people did. I've known a lot of people who did have problems when they came back, especially, because that would have been in the 70s, early 70s. Mm-hmm. And they had a lot of problems with people protesting and stuff and spitting on them and everything else. But I didn't see that, so I can't even vouch for anything like that.
Well, you know, you see all the old newsreels and everything's of things like that. What do you think when you see those type of things, Denny, looking back on your service in the mm-hmm. Vietnam War for our country?
Well, I'm pleased as punch to live in a nation that allows you to do that sort of thing. But on the other hand, when I see all these people protesting about things that I hold so dear, it burns me up. I can't stand it. You know, I won't say I hate the people for it, but I don't like them very much.
Sure.
To put it mildly. They irritate the fool out of me, all these activists that are protesting everything under the sun that I hold so dear. It just, you know,
I don't know if you saw
the
story. This is an aside off from the book, but mm-hmm. the story about the teacher out there in California at a school board meeting. They were doing away with saying the Pledge of Allegiance. Mm-hmm. And this teacher stood up there at the mic holding up an American flag in front of the school board, saying the Pledge of Allegiance. And the moral of the story is now they've decided to reconsider and say the Pledge of Allegiance, but they were doing away with it.
All I can say is God bless her.
Yes.
You know, We do have a lot of people, even in California, that know right from wrong, and you know, it's the same way in New York, where they passed that idiotic rule about abortion. There are a lot of New Yorkers up there that don't like it.
That hold the sanctity of life.
They hold the sanctity of life.
Right. I mean, I read this. I will just talk for a second. We're almost to the bottom of the hour. I read it a couple of nights ago on the internet, and I was like, well, maybe this really isn't true. You know, I better not say anything because I'm not sure it was true. And a couple of days later, yes, it was definitely true.
And now Virginia's trying to do the same thing. The Democrats in Virginia are trying to do the same thing. And it to me, it's appalling.
It is.
I've done a little. Well, I did a little research on how the Nazis in Germany got their hold to start with, and this is reminiscent of the beginnings of the Holocaust. You know, this is infanticide. I mean, you can call it what you know, other people can call it what they want, but that's all it is. It's just pure murder.
It is pure
and
murder.
And I totally disagree with it. And I'm going to do everything I can to fight it from this point on.
Absolutely. It's horrific. The fact that a child could be born and, you know, and be alive, and it could still be killed. That is murder.
Well, this is off the wall. You know, I've got one of my granddaughters was a preemie. She was born at 6 months, spent her first part of her life in the NICU unit at Self Memorial. And, you know, we were told that she would be...
Have issues.
That's the best way to put it. Have a number of issues. Well, the child right now she's a junior in high school. She's got the highest average, not just in her school, but in the entire county. She's athletic. She plays soccer and basketball. And, I mean,
she's a joy.
Wonderful.
She's a joy.
You know, you don't mess around with these folks. And on the news the other day, you know, there was a lady on there who found out just recently she had been more of a feminist, and there's nothing wrong with being a feminist, except she was pretty gung-ho at it. And she found out that her mother was laying down on the bed in a clinic to have an abortion when the mother just decided suddenly to get up and leave.
And that was her.
Yes. So, and it changed her life when she found out that too.
Sure.
So
life is
precious. It's not something to mess with.
Well, that's very true.
And I know that for a lot of reasons too. I've seen a lot of it.
I'm sure.
Been in a hospital unit, I saw a lot of it.
Absolutely. Well, I'll just tell you one quick story, and then we'll probably miss the news, but that's okay. We'll come back after a quick break. I have an older brother that I didn't know that I have, and he has since died, but he was born with Down syndrome. And at the time, this was back in the late 40s, early 50s. I guess it was the early 50s. He was born. They found out that he was Down syndrome. The nurses wanted to put him in a corner and just let him die. And because they said this child will never amount to anything. Well, they didn't do that. And about 50 years later, I got to meet that brother that almost was left in a corner.
That's wonderful. Yeah.
Yeah, it is. And he was just a delight. He had Down syndrome. He didn't speak, but you knew what was in his heart just by the way he acted.
Yeah.
So.
Well, you know, I've been an educator a good portion of my life. And I've dealt with a lot of kids that have Down syndrome and other problems, too. And those are some of the most precious kids you ever saw in your life. And, you know,
how can we just say
we
that?
You just can't issue an edict saying, let's get rid of all these people.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. And I can't.
It shouldn't happen.
I just can't see how you can, the day before you're giving birth, decide that you want to abort a child.
Oh, no.
I mean, that just is over the line.
I do not know.
I agree. All right. Well, let's hear a quick word from our sponsors, Andy. We'll be back. We are here with Denny Burrows. We kind of got off on a tangent, but that's what this show is about. But it is, we are talking about his book, Birds on the Wire and Flares on the Perimeter, A Vietnam Veteran Remembers. And you probably know Denny Burrows, husband of Joanne Burrows. There you go, Joanne. That's for you. We'll be back in just a moment. The antique vintager has arrived in Greenwood. He's been in Greenwood, but he's been incognito. Now unveiled for the very first time, the antique vintager, the one and only Jeff Eller, is debuting on the national stage with his podcast. Shouldn't you be one of the first to come in and see him and see what you have with What's It Worth? Can you sell it? Do you want to sell it? And should you sell it? Only the antique vintager can tell you such things. So come and see us at 637 Durst Avenue East. Call first for your appointment. 864-229-6613. The antique vintager, Jeff Eller, is in the building. Oh, that's right. You're going to want to get this book, Birds on the Wire and Flares on the Perimeter, because it talks all about the observations of Denny Burrows as he was at Fort Hood for a year and then in theater over there in Vietnam and working in the medical field. So he wasn't in combat, but you saw a lot of people that were in combat.
Yeah, that's right. Sure did.
And that must have been horrible.
At times it was, yeah. Actually, there were three, within a 30-mile radius, there were three evacuation hospitals. I was at 12th, which was at the base camp of the 25th Infantry Division. Then there were two more hospitals, actually located right across the street from each other on Long Bend Post, which was, like I said, about 30 miles away. Those two hospitals handled head injuries and burn injuries. We handled amputees.
Wow.
So we saw, I saw a lot of amputees, whole bunch of them. And as a matter of fact, my thinking was rather twisted by the time I came back, because I figured we must have had 10, 15,000 people come back with multiple amputations, missing two legs or two legs and a hand and this type of stuff, because that's what I typically saw every day of the world I was over there. And I was reading this book. Let's see, the guy's last name was Clark. I can't even remember his first name now, but he was a double amputee and had written a book about it. And I was reading a portion of it one day, and he said he was telling about all the injuries that had injured soldiers that had come back from Vietnam, and he said, and 1,081 were multiple amputees. And I went back, I said, wait a minute, that sounds
too low.
Wrong. Yeah. So I went back and read it again, and sure enough, it said that, and I have since found it in other sources. 1,081 multiple amps came back. Well, to me, that is an extremely small number compared to what I was thinking. But then I got to thinking, well, I was at Coochie at the 12th Evac that dealt with amputees. We had all the amputees in
the
area.
You had 1,081. Well,
yeah, we had 1,081 a day, practically. It seemed that way. But I would have guessed that there were so many more than that, when in reality it dawned on me that, hey, down in Long Bend at the other two evac hospitals close to us, even, they might have had a few amputees here and there, but not that many. We got most of them, and then we'd ship them out to Japan once we stabilized them, did surgery on them, stabilized them, then they would be shipped to Japan where they would recuperate. But we saw this, I saw amputees 365 days a year, for the whole year that
right.
I was there, and it gets to you, and it does
how
screw
does
up your thinking
to you?
A little
how
bit.
How does it get to you, Denny?
Well, it's you don't forget it. Bottom line, I'm always saying something about Vietnam this or Vietnam that. I mean, that's just the way I've been all along, and it sticks with you. It stays with you. And I have to hand it to these guys that went through all that stuff. You know, I can't even imagine what they've gone through mentally or emotionally or anything else. But my hat's off to them. And so many of them have come back and done extremely well. You know, they made a life, they made lives for themselves when they came back.
Absolutely.
And I feel like, you know, in some small way, I've been a part of that, you know, that group of people. Even, you know, I'm not a hero by any stretch. I don't mean that. But I'm part of a group of people that really did themselves proud.
Absolutely.
And the people I've, you know, the people that fought, participated in Vietnam and fought in Vietnam, they were as good as anybody in World War II or any other war we've ever seen or been in.
But yet they don't get the accolades.
And they didn't get the accolades. But they're getting it now.
It's
late. It was late, but we're getting it now. So,
absolutely.
And I'm, you know, I appreciate that. It's more than anybody knows.
So. I know you were at the Veterans Hall of Heroes and were inducted into that this past year.
Yes, ma'am.
I bet that was a awesome experience.
It was. I can't say enough about what Kerry Bolt does with that program and with the VA overall. He really does a jam up job. No doubt. And I'm just appreciative, and I'm glad to be a part of it. And I was extremely honored to have been inducted into it.
Talk about something that's a difficult job, that job that Kerry Bolt has as the Veterans Affairs Officer.
It is
emotionally draining.
Yeah, I'm sure it is. I don't know.
Right.
I don't know what all he does. I just know he does a lot of it.
And he's doing it for all veterans that need help.
And while I've got the microphone here, too, I'd like to encourage people to visit the new VA center. It's
phenomenal.
Great. And they've got a museum that is, I would say, for its size and everything, is second to none. And we've got some good people working on it to keep it going. So.
Absolutely. And the exhibits change. And if you have memorabilia, you don't know what to do with it, maybe you don't have anybody in the family that would want it, please consider donating it to the Hall of Heroes Museum right there at the Veterans Center uptown. It's a great repository, and the displays and everything they do are top-notch.
Mm-hmm. It is. They've done a super job with it. I've been so impressed with it.
Yeah.
I hate to say it, but you know, I didn't have a thing to do with it, other than I put a couple of pictures in there.
That's
so.
Right. You did. You did. So when you think back to your time in Vietnam, and I'm sure a lot of stuff was brought up to you that maybe you'd even forgotten about as you were writing this book.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just like, I don't know if you're this way, but I know Jeff was in Vietnam, my husband. And I know that for a while there, the smell of Chinese food would elicit all kinds of flashbacks and everything. Mm-hmm. And we had a hard time figuring out what was causing the problem till a psychiatrist friend of ours said, it's olfactory memory coming back.
Right.
So I'm just curious, as you were writing this book, and a lot of the stories that maybe you started thinking about or you'd forgotten about came to mind, how did it affect you?
I don't know. You know, on a movie, every time I hear a Huey chopper with the blades just flapping the air the way
womp,
they
womp,
do.
Womp,
it's got
womp.
A unique sound.
Yep.
We call it a womp womp bird or whatever. But that brings back a lot of memories right there. I can remember the choppers coming in with patients. I remember flying on them. I didn't fly that much. I wear a hat. I found a hat a while back that said, "Frequent flyer of Vietnam." It's got a picture of a chopper on it. And I was kind of a frequent flyer at times. I didn't qualify for the air medal or anything like that. Didn't do that much flying, but I did get to fly a reasonable amount. And I loved it. But the sounds, even today when a Chinook flies over, it's got a totally different sound, but I still think back.
Yeah, that's what I was meaning. That, yeah. And I'm sure when you were doing some of these stories and everything, mm-hmm. things came back that maybe you had forgotten about or weren't in the top recesses of your mind.
About a couple of years ago, I had some surgery. I can't even remember which. I've had several surgeries, so I can't remember which one it was. But when I woke up in the recovery room, I started babbling to one of the nurses about how this compared with our ICU in Vietnam and everything, and it was like I was back in Vietnam, really. I couldn't help myself. And, you know, and I'm sure they thought I was crazy as a loon, but it just, the circumstances that particular day just brought back a lot of memories from yesteryear.
But, what do you think the overall experience of Vietnam meant to your life?
Well, I think it had a major, played a major role in my life. I told you earlier, too, we were discussing, you know, I taught school for a lot of years. I taught 9 years at Greenwood High School, then I moved to 96. And every Christmas, I would have a slideshow, and I'd show my Vietnam slides and stuff. Of course, I had an audience that couldn't go anywhere. It was a captured audience.
Captive
audience, excuse me. But every year I did it. And I did it more, partly because I was proud of having served, but more, I just wanted them to see what it was like. And, you know, let them experience a little bit, just a little bit of what I experienced. And, you know, because I wasn't crawling through the rice paddies dodging bullets, I saw it a little differently from a lot of the infantry grunts that were there. But so much of the country was just beautiful. It had its own set of smells, there's no doubt. But after you got used to the smells, the beauty of it was unbelievable. I fell in love with Edisto Beach the first time I ever saw it, which was after I had served in Vietnam. When we drove out one day and I saw all this marsh grass, it reminded me of the rice paddies in Vietnam, and they're just gorgeous. And I just fell in love with it totally. Edisto, and I loved Vietnam. I won't say I fell in love with Vietnam, mm-hmm. no, but I you know, the experience for the most part was good, with the exception of all the suffering that was going on too.
So. Now, how many people actually worked at the facility you were at?
Okay, let me see if I can remember. I was stationed at a 400-bed evac hospital. We had 106 officers. That included all the nurses and doctors, as well as the medical admin people like me. We had about 150 enlisted people that worked at the hospital. Then we had about 40 or 50 Vietnamese that worked for us also. So in all, we had somewhere around 300 or 400, between 300 and 400 people that worked at the hospital.
How was it? You know, we always think back to MASH, right? The mm-hmm. movie MASH. When you, it wasn't really like that, was it?
Didn't miss it by much. Didn't miss it by much. You'd be surprised how things can, I won't say get out of hand, but go a little bit wild. When I first arrived there, we had a commander that allowed that sort of thing. And a whole lot depends on your commanding officer, too.
Sure.
But this particular commander, he was kind of laid back. And I know one night, I hadn't been there long, they were throwing rocks and pelting the commander's hooch that he lived in.
Right.
Just for the fun of it. They all gotten a little bit inebriated, and they were throwing rocks and hitting, just bouncing them off the roof of his hooch and everything else. But there were a lot of other things that went on, too. But that was one of the first things I recall. That's not in my book, by the way.
Okay. Well, see, I got something out of him that wasn't in his book.
Yeah, with the book, actually, I'm thinking of things every day of the world that I forgot to put in there.
But see, that's what I'm saying. Uh-huh. Yeah, when you start to remember things, mm-hmm. it
really
changes.
It brings back other memories. It sure does.
Absolutely.
But honestly, if you look at MASH, you know, watch MASH on TV or the movie. Actually, I saw the movie MASH for the first time. It was while I was in Vietnam, but I saw it in Hong Kong with Chinese subtitles.
Good one.
Yeah. Oh, seriously. It was playing in Hong Kong when I was on R&R in Hong Kong.
Okay.
So that's where I saw it. But it's not as fictitious as people would think.
Really?
Because, well, if you think about it, what the doctors and nurses especially have to go through, what they are going through, they've got to vent somehow or other. And that's the way they do it. They do some crazy stuff sometimes.
Did you have Hot Lips over there? You know, Loretta Swift, you know, the...
Well, let's put it this way. I didn't have Hot Lips over there, no. but there were some that would probably qualify,
Qualify.
But overall, let me say this. The nurses that were there, and we had a lot of them, they were about as professional and... about as professional as they could be, and they were wonderful. I mean, they did a super job under the worst of circumstances. I mean,
do you think it was okay? Just out of curiosity, and you're talking to the nurses and everything. Do we think it was harder for them because, well, being women? And do you think it made any difference? Was it harder for them to deal with this? Or
In a lot of ways, I think so. Yeah. You know, just the fact that they were female and they were outnumbered big time. But just, you know, their training, you know, I think about our training. You know, when I went in as a medical administrator, I mean, and I'm going to call it that for lack of a better term right now, they put me in a stateside assignment first at Fort Hood, and I kind of learned the ropes there. Then I got sent to Vietnam. Nurses didn't get that. They got their commission. They got direct commissions into the Army as officers. They went to Fort Sam Houston in Texas for about 6 weeks, 6 or 8 weeks. I think it was 8. To just be oriented toward the Army, how to wear the uniform and all this kind of stuff. Then they got sent straight to Vietnam in many, many cases. And stateside, they couldn't do much. I mean, you know, even with patients, they weren't allowed to do that much. Nurses of that day weren't allowed to do that much. At that time, they couldn't do IVs and stuff stateside, or in most states, they couldn't. When they arrived in country in Vietnam, they were put into situations where they were doing everything practically, almost everything the doctor would do right there with them. So they had some learning to do real quick.
Wow.
And it was a tough job, and they did it well. They did it extremely well.
Yeah.
And I'm proud to have known them, known a lot of them.
Absolutely.
So it's.
But, you know, you just think about that, and you think about the differences. And then, like, you know, bringing up about MASH, you know, you just think about, you know, that used to be such a favorite show to watch. And when the choppers came in, you know, incoming.
I liked the TV series much better than I did the movie. The movie was a little bit out there, way out there. But the TV series was a whole lot truer, I guess, in a lot of ways. Mm. A little more realistic.
Absolutely. So you said we're running out of time, unfortunately, but to do what did you do when you weren't hospital administrating? What things did you like to do?
Well,
I know you said you took pictures.
Yeah, well, everybody took pictures. And, you know, that was one of the first things you did was you got yourself a good camera. And I was not a camera person, so I didn't know anything about f-stops and all this other stuff. So I bought one of I remember it was called an Electro 35 camera. It was a nice camera, about the size of a single-lens reflex camera, but it was an automatic-type point-and-shoot kind of camera. And I got some good pictures with it. You know, I took a lot of slides as well as just regular pictures, too.
But then, what else did you like to do besides the
Well, there wasn't time to do much else. You know, I mean, other than your job, you were, you know, it was busy. And being medical service in the situation I was in, we had duty a lot. You know, some usually on the average, I had the duty officer, which was nighttime duty, about twice a week. So a lot of my time was spent in uniform. I mean, you know, in uniform at nights or whatever. But we did. We read books. I actually, one of my extra duties was developing a library, a full-fledged library with complete with a thousand or so, several thousand volumes of books. And
stuff. Where'd the books come from?
It was special Army Special Services. Now, where they got the funding, it wasn't through the USO. It was through some other department in the Army. But they provided us the money, and they'd ship the books to us and everything. We just had to build the library. And wow. That was one of my jobs. And,
as
a matter of fact, I had to go down and drive down to Saigon, pick up all the carpet squares for the floor. And as it turns out, I was by myself when I did that.
Yes.
And I got caught up in traffic, and here I was in a Jeep with several thousand blue carpet squares, me and my pistol, and 5 million Vietnamese totally surrounding me. And needless to say, I was a little bit nervous at that time. And it was a traffic jam, and here we were. I mean, just I was totally surrounded by no American GIs or anything. And I kept my pistol handy, and I was constantly looking one every direction I could look to make sure there wasn't a grenade going to come popping over into my Jeep, which probably wouldn't happen anyway, but you never knew.
Right.
You know, that was the thing about it. And after about an hour or so of that kind of mess, I finally got out on the roads and got back to Cu Chi with no problem. But there were a few anxious moments there. But, you know, we listened to music. You know, all of us had some kind of music machine, whether it was a radio or tape deck or whatever, and we did that. We got out and we ran. Played basketball but volleyball. Mm-hmm. We had a volleyball court actually built at the hospital. So there were a lot of things we're able to do to occupy some of your extra time. And you wrote letters home. I wrote one to Joe every day of the world.
Every day. Does she still have those?
No, actually.
Oh, come on.
She had kept every one of them. Had about 360 some letters.
Right.
And she asked me one day, we were going through some stuff, and you know, in one of those clean out moves, and she had this big stack of letters. She said, "What do you want to do with these?" And I thought, well, it's got a lot of mushy stuff in them that kids don't need to see. Just throw them away.
Oh, Lord.
And I could kick myself many times over, but we threw them away.
Oh,
so
Lord.
So I've got just a few letters that I've managed to find here and there. That either she wrote me or I wrote her. Very few left over.
Wow.
But it was a whole year's history in those letters, too, in addition to the mush that was there. I wish to goodness I had saved them. But,
oh, my goodness.
Well, thank goodness I did have a lot of slides and other pictures. You know, that I came home with. So
do you think you're going to write another book?
I doubt it, seriously.
Maybe an addendum to some of the things you missed from the first book?
No, it won't be another book about Vietnam. If I ever wrote another book, it would probably be about my experiences in the classroom or something like that, you know, in schools. So, got a lot of memories of that, too, because I had a good career after the Army. I decided, you know, when I first went into the Army, I was planning on making it a career. After my two-year commitment, I decided, I don't think I'm want to do that. So I went into education, but I stayed in the reserves for the next 22 years. Mm-hmm. Along that. So I really had kind of the best of both worlds. And but I've got a lot of memories from an educational standpoint, too. Needless to say, God's been good to me.
Well, I think it is pretty, pretty awesome. You are listening to WCRS right here in Greenwood. Danny, we would be doing a disservice if we didn't talk about your two children. Tara, who is at the Piedmont Tech and the nursing department over there, over mm-hmm. that. I know she makes you very, very proud.
She sure does, every day of the world. She's just taken on more than just the nursing department recently. She's now dean of I've forgotten her title, but it's Dean of Medical Services, I think, or something.
Over the whole department.
But it's the nursing department as well as all of medical
technology
stuff. Yeah.
My respiratory and all that.
Right. She's over the whole nine yards.
Does she ever come home?
not too much.
Not too much. But I know are very, very proud of her.
She puts in long days and has to do a lot of traveling with it, too.
Absolutely.
And
Then, of course, your son, Todd.
He is career Army. Now, he took it a little different path. He decided he wanted to jump out of airplanes, so he did that for a long time. But he's airborne infantry, and he loves what he does. He's had one tour in Afghanistan, a full year's tour there, and then two tours in Afghanistan and one in Iraq. His tour in Iraq, he went over thinking it was going to be a 6-month rotational tour that they normally do. Mm-hmm. When his feet hit the ground, they extended it to 15 months.
Wow!
And he was an infantry company commander at the time, right outside of Sadr City, where everything was going on. And we're lucky to have him here.
His
first tour in Afghanistan, he had a lot of close calls, but he's done extremely well for himself. He's currently the commander of the Old Guard Battalion in Washington, D.C. And the Old Guard, they're the people that do all the ceremonial stuff, including the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier. So he commands all of that stuff, and he's done extremely well. He's a lieutenant colonel now, and we're hoping to see him go even a whole lot higher than that before it's over with. So
I know you say he goes to the White House quite often.
Frequently, he goes to the White House for meetings and stuff. And a while back, he sent us a picture, and he was walking with General Mattis, who at that time was still Secretary of Defense. They were walking across a parade field or something. He was there in full uniform, right with the guy.
Yeah,
but he sees a lot of what we consider famous people all the time. So
I know you're very, very proud.
We are very proud of both of them. Yeah. We just love them both to death, and they've done so well.
And wouldn't be right if we didn't at least mention your wonderful wife, Joanne, here.
Yes, definitely. I owe a whole lot to her. She's for those of you out there that don't know, she's the author of the book Jonathan and Teacher. And she has done just a wonderful job with that since she's retired. She's a retired educator just like I am, but she was a far better educator than I was. So, but she just keeps us going. And she's now the chairman of the Greenwood County GOP, the Republican Party here. So, and doing a fantastic job with that, too. So, talk about being proud. I am extremely proud of her.
And during the 2016 election, she played Hillary Clinton in a debate that I was the moderator
in.
She did an excellent job for many of you that saw the pictures of that.
Yes.
That's right.
But we'd like to invite anybody and everybody to come out and join us at the GOP meetings, too.
That's right. You've got a meeting coming up Monday night.
This coming Monday night. It'll be at the library, at the Veterans Center in the library. Not at the Veterans Center, but at the Veterans. What do you call it?
Well, it's at the Greenwood County
Library.
Yeah,
it's at the Greenwood County Library anyway. Yeah.
That's right.
The big room there.
And Hope Walker is going to be the speaker. Yeah. She's the executive director of the South Carolina GOP. We're trying to get her to come on the show maybe Monday afternoon before she goes there. So we'll see if we can work that out. But they would love to see you there. Denny, you know, this has been a great hour spent together talking.
Well, I've enjoyed it, and I appreciate you having me so much.
Absolutely, so. And I hope that people are going to be moved to go out and buy his book, Birds on the Wire, Flares on the Perimeter, and he will be at McCaslin's this Saturday afternoon from 11 to 1. So come out, see Denny, and I know many of you know Denny. You may not have known he's written a book, but now you do. And Denny Burroughs, Colonel Denny Burroughs, thank you for your service to your country and to your community.
All right. Well, thank you so much.
All right. That's going to do it.
Yep.
That's going to do it for us. This is WCRS right here in Greenwood. Bye-bye, everybody.